It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back with me tomorrow. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, as the transgender community grows, parents and medical professionals are facing new questions and challenges. We'll talk to the producer of a new Frontline documentary that digs into those questions. First, a look at the latest news on one of the sticking points in Wisconsin's state budget, the Milwaukee Bucks arena deal. Earlier this month, Governor Scott Walker, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley, and Republican leaders in the legislature unveiled a deal that would have taxpayers cover half the cost of the $500 million arena in downtown Milwaukee. Yesterday, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss released the details of this plan. Here to break them down for us is Sean Johnson, state government reporter for WPR News. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So this is, I thought this was a new deal when I first saw the headlines. This is the details on the old deal, the one that was first announced earlier this month.
Yeah, there was just an exceedingly long gap between when they introduced this deal and when we actually saw the details of it. This is basically the deal that the governor announced with Chris Abley, with Tom Barrett, Scott Fitzgerald, and Robin Voss. But we never saw anything other than a bullet point list on that. Yesterday, Assembly Speaker Voss released the actual legislative language, you know, the bill that would create this new Bucks financing package. And along with that, kind of more importantly for the rest of us, a plain language analysis from the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau that broke it down. And so you can kind of understand more of the machinations of this deal.
So what we knew already was roughly what part of the funding was coming from what part of the government. So some from the state, some from the city, some from the county. What kind of new stuff did we learn as we got these details?
One of the big things is it just spelled out the fact that the public share of this is not just $250 million if you look at interest costs. So, you know, the state, for example, is going to issue $55 million worth of bonds. The county would issue $55 million worth of bonds. This Wisconsin Center District, which is in Milwaukee, would issue $93 million worth of bonds. Interest costs in those, though, would climb between interest and principal, would climb to almost $380 million. So, kind of puts it all in one place, and you can see that the costs aren't quite as simple as they were maybe initially presented. Although, you know, again, it's pretty close to the broad strokes of what was presented in early June.
The costs aren't as straightforward, and some of the ways of paying for them aren't straightforward. Somehow this affects how Milwaukee, for example, would handle parking tickets and home foreclosures. How did that all fit into this equation?
Yeah, we knew that again in early June, but you see now in this proposal that they're making a number of changes to state law in order to make it easier to try to go after this outstanding debt for people that owe this money in Milwaukee County, because this is how Milwaukee County is supposed to come up with its share of that bonding. And if it can't, Milwaukee County gets its state aid cut by however much the state can't collect. So it's important to Milwaukee that it be able to get after this money. It can't do it now. And so there are several changes in there that would give the state more power to collect this money.
And you mentioned the arena authority, and we learned this deal gives Governor Walker's administration that authority. So how does that work? What are people saying about that?
I'm not sure yet what people are going to think about that. I mean, that's similar to, there are other areas of state law where the Secretary of Administration has pretty broad authority. For example, the DOA secretary would be the one negotiating gaming compacts, would be the one in charge of deciding whether or not, I guess the governor always gets the final say, but the DOA secretary would have the say in locating off-reservation casinos, whether to approve those for the state's end of thing. Here, the DOA secretary would have pretty broad authority when it comes to this Bucks Arena deal. Right now, the DOA secretary is Republican, appointed by Republican Governor Scott Walker. The legislature is run by Republicans, so that might color how they view this. If the political makeup of state government right now is different, it might be a different story.
Talking to WPR's own Sean Johnson about the latest news on the Milwaukee Bucks arena proposal. Let's get to the political side here, Sean. This has stood out as one of the sticking points in the state budget. Deadline, I believe, is today, right? Technically, to get that budget done. Doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Definitely not going to happen. If you wanted to get the budget done before the start of the next budget year, which is tomorrow, you'd need to have it signed by today. There's just no way. It's completely impossible. That's not going to happen. It's not a crisis because in Wisconsin, the way that state government works is if there's not a new budget in place on July 1st, the budget from the last year just carries over. And so that gives the legislature and governor some leeway to reach a new agreement. At some point, it could be a headache for them. But in the early going, they have some time. The thing is, if they give themselves that time, they can kind of let it continue to get pushed off and pushed off. I mean, you consider the Joint Finance Committee hasn't met for a month now, so it gets easier to not meet. And so they run that risk. If they don't get something done now, it could stretch into the summer.
So the assembly leadership is releasing these details today. There, Robin Voss talking about trying to move forward on a vote, trying to get the Senate to take action here. What do you make of the assembly kind of pushing this forward?
It sure seems like the assembly is trying to get the Senate to move. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is saying, we have the votes to pass these things right now. We could pass our own prevailing wage proposal. We could pass this Bucks deal. It's really the Senate where there are questions. And so he's saying, if the Senate doesn't come out with something by the end of the week and say they have the votes for their own budget package, the Assembly is just going to move. We're going to pass a budget on our own. I think, you know, that's probably, if that were to happen, that would probably signal pretty big breakdown between Republicans and a sign that they can't get together on this. But they are meeting privately this week. The Senate Republicans are, Assembly Republicans are. And so they have a goal of wrapping things up here soon.
With this arena deal in particular, one of the sticking points in that budget, there's Republican opposition. It's not clear that the Senate would have enough Republicans who would vote for this thing. Is that right?
That is correct. And so Republicans are talking about taking the Bucks arena deal out of the budget and passing it as a standalone bill, or trying to pass it as a standalone bill. AP was reporting today that one Republican senator, Luther Olson, was saying that the Senate would remove the Bucks Stadium proposal from the budget, which would mean they would be seeking Democratic votes for this in the legislature. That gets tricky, though, because for one, Democrats are going to insist on some changes, you can be sure, if the Republicans need them for this. Democrats have rare leverage, and they're probably going to use it. So if they insist on these changes, what's that going to mean for Republican votes? And also then you get into kind of internal Milwaukee politics. I mean, this deal gives Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abele pretty broad authority to do things that would typically require county board approval. There are some Milwaukee lawmakers who are going to object to that. And so, you're going to have to see how that plays out if they need Democratic votes for this thing.
A lot of moving parts here, Sean. Thanks, as always, for keeping us up to date on this.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's state government reporter, with us to talk about the details of the plan to build a new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks in downtown Milwaukee. As the gay and lesbian communities have seen dramatically more social acceptance in the past decade, the focus of the LGBT rights movement has shifted a bit more toward the T in LGBT, transgender. In the past, transgender people largely came out later in life as adults. But with more visibility and awareness, more and more children are identifying as transgender as well. Last year, for example, here in Central Time, we spoke with a transgender 6-year-old girl and her mother from rural Wisconsin about their experience at home and in their community. As the trans community grows younger, kids have more options, but those options raise questions and challenges for parents, medical professionals, and the kids themselves. Frontline digs into those questions in their new documentary, Growing Up Trans. It airs tonight at 9 on your local public television station. Here with us now is the producer of that documentary, Karen O'Connor. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, as you explore this issue and talk to families, is it a new thing that kids are identifying as transgender?
I think it is, or certainly the scale and scope of it is new, and I think, as you described it, the growing visibility. I mean, in recent years, I think the most striking change for trans people, really, is this possibility of switching genders at younger and younger ages, and a growing number of kids across the country are, as you described, in your community there, too, starting to live as the opposite gender, called social transition, and that's happening as early as preschool, and then as they get older and head towards puberty, then begins the decision and dilemmas about medical interventions that were not possible in this country until 2007. So it's all relatively new, and it's changed everything for transgender people everywhere.
Yeah, what used to be the trajectory for a trans person's life? When did they start making transitions?
Typically it was adults who at least moved towards medical interventions. In this country in the late 50s, you probably heard of Christine Jorgensen, and then later Renee Richards, a fairly well-known tennis player, they were called transsexuals at the time. So largely any medical interventions, and it was usually surgery, was limited to adults, and then it all kind of shifted in this country within the last decade, and that's largely with the introduction of medicines called puberty blockers, which allow doctors now to delay and suspend puberty so that kids now who feel as if they've been born in the wrong body don't ever have to go through the biological sex of their birth sex. So it's changed everything pretty dramatically.
Now, in the past, and probably many people have encountered kids who don't entirely match socially their gender role, you know, the traditional or stereotypical tomboy, or in Free to Be You and Me, there was the Billy mm-hmm. Has a Doll segment.
Sure.
But in talking to these kids, watching this documentary, there's a big difference, it seems like, between that kind of nonconformity and knowing, feeling that you're transgender at a young age.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's right. There have always been, forever, kids and people who defy gender norms, and there have always been those who fall outside that binary. But yes, this is very different, and according to all the experts and according to the kids themselves, it's a very kind of deep and profound disconnect between that's very different from feeling as if they're even a kind of feminine boy or a more boyish girl, those classic tomboy associations. This is very different. This is feeling something fundamentally off in one's essential identity, and often known by the kind of intensity of the distress around body, puberty, those kinds of things.
Well, the bulk of this Frontline documentary is following the stories of different kids going through this experience. And I want to touch on one or maybe two of those. Can you start by telling us about Ariel? She transitioned to female at a pretty young age.
She did. Ariel is a 13-year-old when we meet her. She was born male, grew up as Ian, and then around middle school, 11 years old, starts to live more publicly as a girl. She, before that, is a little of what you described. She describes herself as a kid in the middle, a more feminine boy, until she realized she wasn't a feminine boy. She really felt as if she was a girl. So Ariel started on puberty blockers at 11. That changed everything. She has a look very different from what would have been a transgender adult. She, for all intents and purposes, you would never know, though it gave her the possibility to kind of go secret into her middle school and where she was outed in a school locker room. But she's been on puberty blockers and started cross-sex hormones this year at 14. So she, in some way, is this extraordinarily articulate, self-aware young woman who is one of the kids, and they're all quite remarkable, who I think make pretty vivid what it is to experience being transgender.
Well, I want to give a listen to Ariel and her mother now talking about how Ariel first started identifying as a girl. We've got a clip here.
So she asked us to call her a different Disney princess name every day. So every day, every day we had a different name, and there was an order to it. Cinderella, Belle, Ariel, Snow White, and they were in order, all the Disney princesses. And on that day, I would have to call her that.
And I remember my grandmother, she cared so much about me that she wrote on her calendar every day, like, what princess I was supposed to be.
So she would make sure she called you the right name.
It just made me think, like, she cares about me so much that she writes on her calendar who I am each day. Which was really amazing and made me so happy.
Now, you talked to a number of families here, Karen, who had different attitudes toward this change. How much difference did you see in the families? How much difference did a support from a family like we just heard about from Ariel make for these kids?
I think it's a pretty wide-ranging view in the film. Ariel's mom is very supporting and affirming. You meet not long into the film Alex, who's same age, whose parents are struggling and very concerned about the medications, though they aren't sure they have any other options, to Kyle, who's 13 himself, whose father is very worried about a 13-year-old making these life-changing decisions that will in some case be irreversible, and then John Blanchard, who's 16, and his father, a deeply religious man who is just opposed to both kind of homosexuality and transgenderism, and so Bert articulates what it is from his point of view to what he describes lose his daughter. So I think the film, in the kind of full trajectory of it, tries to represent a pretty wide range of not only the kids, but the parental reactions to it as well.
Talking to Karen O'Connor, producer of the new Frontline documentary, Growing Up Trans. Now, you've mentioned the puberty blocker medications, Karen, and regardless of family support here, this is really uncharted territory in a lot of ways. These are medicines being used in new ways, not a long track record. What did you hear from families wrestling with, agonizing over this, the decision here?
I think it's the toughest for them. It is a world of unknowns, and the parents are struggling with it. All of the parents, I would say, and also the doctors. We meet some extraordinary doctors along the way working in these gender clinics, and they couldn't be more direct and honest about what they're dealing with. This is a new kind of medicine, as one doctor describes. It's disconcerting to be dealing with so many unknowns, but that's kind of where they are with it, and they're all navigating this new world, but it's an area with limited research and very few studies. So in some ways, these kids are going to be, as they're described, the pioneers. They're going to be the ones who let everybody know some years down the road what these decisions meant.
And you, in this documentary, are actually in the doctor's, a real doctor's office with real families having these conversations. How did you get this kind of access? What was it like to be in there in these pivotal life-changing moments?
Yeah, it was really kind of amazing, and we felt very fortunate that the families entrusted us with their stories this way, and the doctors. We got unprecedented access to the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago, and worked with a team there. But all across the country, the families were really quite amazing. It was moving. It was eye-opening. It was revealing. It was surprising, all that you would expect. And to come in on literally in real time with moms and dads and doctors making these decisions while we're there, really following it as it was unfolding, was really quite extraordinary.
And a common theme among the kids who are trying to make this transition before puberty is a fear of puberty. It's the time, one of them says, where they become exactly what they don't want to be. How did they talk about that?
Yeah, that's an amazing one. That's true. That's Alex, the 13-year-old who was born female in transition. That's right. Everything he dreads, everything he didn't want would be that. He's wishing for, you know, which he's wearing three sports bras and self-conscious about his chest. In that case, Alex transitioned too late for puberty blockers, so he missed that window. So now he's talking already about starting testosterone and someday having what's called top surgery, which would be a double mastectomy. I mean, it's all slightly disorienting to hear 13-year-olds, you know, looking down the road like that. Ariel talks about the worst thing in her life would be to get a beard and an Adam's apple. So she's been spared that. So the stories, you see the contrast between a kid like Ariel who's had these and then kids like John and Kyle who have not. So the the difference is almost generational. Arielle represents this new generation of trans kids who have an entirely new look and new possibilities for blending in and for kind of living inconspicuously that was never possible before. So it's the thing that was the most thrilling, is to have the kids take you inside their world in this way. I didn't know anything about it, and it was just absolutely revelatory. Wherever you are on the issue, the kids are quite remarkable.
We'll leave it there. Karen, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
We've been speaking with Karen O'Connor. She's a producer with Frontline, and the documentary we've been talking about, she produced it. It's called Growing Up Trans. You can see that tonight at 9 on your local public television station. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This time of year, recent graduates of high schools, colleges, trade schools in Wisconsin are sizing up the job market, making decisions about where to work, where to live in the coming years. Wisconsin, a lot of times, struggles to compete for that young talent with neighboring states or with the coasts that offer larger urban areas. There's anxiety about a brain drain in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's Secretary of Workforce Development, Reggie Newsom, recently wrote an op-ed. It appeared in the Green Bay Press Gazette. He assured recent grads that Wisconsin has the jobs and the lifestyles they're looking for. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a recent graduate? How are you making your choice about where to work, where to live, what industries you're interested in? If you're older, what went into your decision to stay in Wisconsin or maybe move to Wisconsin and work here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Here with us now is Reggie Newsom. He's Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Secretary Newsom, thanks a lot for joining us here in the studio.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So what are Wisconsin's biggest assets in terms of what it has to offer for that young talent, those new grads I was talking about?
Well, I've had the opportunity to spend some time with young professionals over the last few weeks, and one of our tremendous assets throughout the state is Wisconsin is a great place to raise a family. We have great schools. We have the best-in-class educational system here in Wisconsin, whether it be K through 12, our technical colleges, our 2 and 4 universities, both public and private. We have great amenities here. The city of Madison is a great place. We have the lakes. We have great things to do in the city of Milwaukee. We have Summerfest, which is going on right now, which people take for granted. So in terms of what we call urban renaissance for young professionals in the cities, Milwaukee, Madison, Racine, Green Bay, Racine and Kenosha, there's a lot to do. And in some of the smaller cities in rural areas of Wisconsin, again, great places to raise families, great neighbors, and great things to do. We have winter tourism, all the great winter sports that we offer here in Wisconsin. So Wisconsin has tremendous assets, and we want to spend time over the next few weeks talking about those things and do everything we can to encourage young people to stay in Wisconsin when they graduate.
Right. Those things are out there, but are they front and center in people's minds when they're thinking Wisconsin?
Well, I think so. I just spent some time over at Zendesk with some young professionals, and every young professional I talked to were very familiar with what Madison offers, the festivals, all the opportunities, the arts, the culture. So they're very familiar. But I think we can continue to do a job, and as I say, the biggest room is room for improvement, of touting all those tremendous assets in our urban areas and talk about all the assets in the smaller cities, the suburbs, the exurbs, and the rural areas of the state.
Now, a phrase I mentioned a few moments ago, brain drain. I've heard it from experts looking at the state as a whole. You hear it from people in smaller towns around the state. People get educated, and a lot of them, some of them, move out of town, maybe move out of the state. Is brain drain real? Is this a problem for Wisconsin?
Well, actually, if you look at the data, and let me just break it down like this, in terms of UW graduates, graduates that are from Wisconsin that attend the UW systems, they do tend to stay here in Wisconsin, but we want them all to stay. And what we can do a better job is making sure that graduates that are graduating from our schools from Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, we want to keep them here too. So that's why we're spending time making sure we talk to young professionals, because we want to keep all the talent in Wisconsin. We're selfish like that because we have employers that have needs. And again, we want to make sure that we have talent talent that can contribute to our communities, invest here, and make Wisconsin the best state in the nation.
So how do you, I mean, talking to people, there's a lot of them to talk to. How do you communicate that message to that young talent?
Well, the first thing you do is you get out and talk to them, you listen to them. I was just over at Zendesk a couple of weeks ago. I was up in Appleton at the Weinert Group, and I asked them, I said, from a policy standpoint, if there's something I can share with the governor or the legislature, a big policy idea that would convince you to stay. And to the fall, I heard things such as making sure that we have internship opportunities for young people because they want to gain valuable work experience. And I think there's some things we can do on that front that we're already doing in the state around internships, apprenticeships, and co-ops. Some other things that we talked about and I heard from them is making sure that we continue to tout all the urban renaissance in the state. And we're going to continue to do that. I know that my colleague, Secretary Klett of the Department of Tourism, does a fine job of talking about the state on that front. But again, the most important thing I think we can do is listen to them and work with them, but and also connect them to employers. Make sure employers are doing all the proactive things they can do to make sure their companies and businesses are an attractive place for young people to work.
So outside of the lifestyle, of course, a big question about for people looking for a job is there a job that I want that's going to pay me a decent amount to maybe let me raise a family? Do we have enough of those jobs for our graduates?
I think so. If you look at the state's unemployment rate at 4.6%, it's the lowest it's been since the fall of 2008. On our Job Center Wisconsin website, the state's labor exchange, we've constantly had job postings on there between 80 and 90,000 for the last several months. And if you look at all these jobs on there, they're high-paying jobs, from entry-level to high-paying jobs, management jobs, jobs across a variety of industries and sectors, information technology, tech jobs, manufacturing jobs, construction, healthcare, agriculture, you name it, they're on there. And what I hear from employers is that they want to hire talent. They want to provide job opportunities. I think the one thing that we always have to continue to work very, very hard on is connecting the talent to the employer. And that takes hard work in terms of making sure we open communication channels, making sure that employers know where they can go to find talent, but also making sure that the young people, when they are selling their wares to employers, they're doing it around skill sets and they are prepared to be able to articulate what they can bring to these businesses.
Talking to Reggie Newsom, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, he says, hey, graduates of high school, college, technical college, there are good opportunities and a good lifestyle for you here in Wisconsin. Now, you mentioned the needs of employers. Another phrase we hear a lot in the state is the idea of a skills gap, that employers have jobs open, the people graduating don't have the skills to do those jobs. Is this a reality in the state?
Well, I think there is a mismatch based on what employers are looking for a skill set and what prospective job seekers can offer. I know that one of the things that I hear from employers above technical skill sets, the people skills, or some of the analytical skills, the ability to problem solve and have critical thinking skills. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact, as I mentioned before, making sure that internships and co-ops and work-based learning opportunities are available for high school students when they're in high school and college students so they can develop and hone those skill sets and accentuate and enhance them. Because I think the foundation is there, but practice makes perfect. And we want to make sure we provide those opportunities through the internships, the co-ops, the apprenticeships to be able to enhance and build and practice those skills. And I think if we can do that and provide those opportunities, employers would be more satisfied with the available talent in the labor market.
Start bringing our callers in now. We've got Jim on the line in Eau Claire. Jim, hi.
Hi. Secretary Newsom, you're just being disingenuous. You really are, because this administration has did nothing but cut education. Those tickets are going to come home to roost. We will start not having the talent. We'll start not having the opportunity. I contend it's already started happening. I'm really just ashamed to be a Wisconsinite during this administration with the war that you guys have declared and the Republicans have declared on education and on the working class of the state.
Jim, thanks for the call. Secretary Newsom, cuts to K-12 education and past budgets. Obviously, the university budget has loomed large in budget negotiations. Is this going to damage some of that Wisconsin lifestyle, brand, and job training that you've been talking about?
Sure. Let me just say this, that education, talent development, workforce development are bipartisan issues. And I'm happy to say that over the last 4 years, and the governor and legislature have worked very in concert and agreed on these issues. That's why the governor and the legislature has invested over $150 million in workforce development, worker training in Wisconsin. Many of these dollars are going to our K through 12 schools throughout the state of Wisconsin, technical colleges. There's been an investment of nearly $30 million for technical colleges in Wisconsin to be able to expand and add courses and nights and weekends, hire instructors to be able to bring in folks to be able to train people that were waiting to get into high demand courses and classes at tech colleges to be able to bring those people in to train them. So there's been a significant investment on this type of thing. And in the budget, the joint finance, actually, in this budget that's being deliberated right now, actually has increased K through 12 spending in the state of Wisconsin. Now, the issue of the university, again, I think going forward, I know the governor has proposed some additional flexibilities in the UW system to allow them to be able to gain efficiencies. And the legislature has taken a different position on that. But I believe that going forward, we have some of the finest universities in the nation here in Wisconsin. And I know in talking to some of the UW chancellors I've spent time with, they're going to continue to move forward, providing opportunities and making sure that Wisconsinites and outstate residents that attend our fine universities get a quality education.
Now, school leaders have and others have said, okay, a little increase in this budget doesn't make up for past cuts. I mean, do you think there's still room to rebound the K through 12 budget? Would that pay off in terms of the things we're talking about, quality of life, job training in the state?
Well, again, every member of the legislature I've talked to on both sides of the aisle, I know the governor feels the same way, believes very strongly in education. And again, I have opportunity to travel throughout the nation. I talk to my counterparts in other states, labor secretaries, workforce development secretaries, and everyone I talk to, they envy Wisconsin in terms of the quality of our K through 12, the institutions, the tech colleges, the 2 and 4 year universities. And if you look at things such as the ACT scores in Wisconsin, we're constantly in the top 5 in terms of ACT scores. We have other states that are right now working very hard to recruit graduates from our high schools to go to their schools in the Southeast, for example, in SEC, Alabama, Missouri, Mississippi, Missouri, and Georgia. They're constantly in our K through 12 schools trying to recruit our talent. So again, with all that said, again, moving forward, I feel very optimistic that the resources will be there and we'll continue to be able to produce quality people and educated people in Wisconsin.
We're talking to Reggie Newsom, Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development, about his case for why young graduates should live and work in Wisconsin. Good opportunities, good lifestyle opportunities out there too, he says. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're a recent graduate, how are you making this choice? Are you trying to stay in Wisconsin, trying to get out? So what factors are weighing in that decision? If you are an employer, are you looking to hire those new grads from high school, from university, from technical colleges? What would you like to see from them? What do you have to offer? What does the state have to offer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Reggie Newsom, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. He recently wrote an op-ed in the Green Bay Press-Gazette making the argument that recent graduates of high schools, colleges, and trade schools should embrace careers in Wisconsin. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions or thoughts about Wisconsin's job market? Are you one of these recent grads who chose to stay in Wisconsin? Why'd you make that decision if you left and came back? Tell us that story, too. And again, if you're an employer, are you looking to hire people right out of school? Are you looking to hire more of them right now? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get back to our callers, Secretary Newsom, you referred to a business that described itself as having a startup mentality in that piece you wrote in the Press Gazette. A lot of people looking to attract startups. You think of places like the coast, the big cities there. We talked to someone who'd written a study recently saying Wisconsin not looking so good. Among the last in the nation when it comes to startup activity. What do we need to do to improve the startup climate here in Wisconsin?
Well, one thing we need to do is make sure that entrepreneurs understand that there are resources available in the state of Wisconsin to be able to start up businesses. We know that startups and small businesses are the ones that are creating jobs currently in the economy. And whether it's resources at the Economic Development Corporation or local economic development corporations, I know that MadRep and the work they're doing over there, work that Zach Brandon's doing with his organization, they're doing a very, very good job of providing those type of resources to encourage and incentivize entrepreneurs. But the one thing that we can continue to do is make sure that we have a skilled workforce, because people with skills and good ideals are the ones that create jobs and go out and start businesses. So we want to make sure we create those pathways and pipelines for the folks to be able to do that.
Go back to our callers now with Sam in Elkhart Lake. Sam, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I appreciate your guys' conversation.
What do you think, Sam?
Well, I wanted to echo the first caller, but maybe from a younger perspective. I'm 30. My sister's 22. She just graduated from MIAD. We grew up in Milwaukee. My girlfriend graduated a year ago, soil science in Stevens Point. And them and a lot of the other younger people I talk to get frustrated in Wisconsin. You know, making money and a good job are definitely important, but they don't make or break someone's life, I don't think. And a lot of the public services that we grew up enjoying in Wisconsin, like museums, buses, state parks, and, of course, the education system, we've seen get worse and worse. And so a lot of the young people I talk to, and myself included, I'm just really frustrated and kind of don't want to be in an environment where people act like this.
Sam, thanks for the call. So worried about investment in those quality of life things, state parks, he said, arts and other things like that. Are these important parts of the equation here? Are you worried about funding cuts, maybe pushing people like Sam to look for jobs out of the state?
Sure. Well, again, as I talk about the amenities in Wisconsin, we have great amenities here. Again, I talk to folks from other parts of the states. I have a very unique perspective that they spend a lot of time coming to our state parks. Right now, this weekend, the 4th of July weekend, we're going to have hundreds of people, thousands of people traveling up 94 and up 45, going and up 43 to our state parks. So they're going to enjoy those type of things, great tourism, great attractions. One thing that we take for granted right now in the city of Milwaukee is Summerfest. And we have thousands of people that are traveling to Wisconsin from other parts of the nation, other parts of the world, to enjoy Summerfest. And again, those amenities are here. I think sometimes we take them for granted, but they're here. And again, we shouldn't take them for granted. And we want to continue to do everything we can to make sure that we tout them and make sure that folks know about them.
Now, let's stay in Milwaukee for a moment. When young people are thinking of exciting big cities to move to, you know, New York, San Francisco, upcoming places like Portland and Seattle are often on the list. What needs to happen to put Milwaukee higher on that list?
Well, again, making sure that folks understand what Milwaukee has to offer. I live in Milwaukee. I've been a lifelong resident of the city of Milwaukee, and there's been a great renaissance in Milwaukee in terms of economic development downtown. If you go downtown, you can enjoy all the amenities downtown there, the museums, the culture, the arts, the concerts, all that stuff downtown. And again, making sure that we talk about Wisconsin and the cities here, that these are great places to raise a family. And if you're looking at having a very, very consistent middle-class experience, a great place to raise a family, Wisconsin nice, is something I hear a lot about from my colleagues in other parts of the country, that we have great neighbors. We have nice people that are here that treat people well, and all those virtues of living in Wisconsin. We can't take that for granted. We got to continue to, you know, shout from the rooftops about that type of thing.
Talking to Reggie Newsom, Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development, about jobs, careers here in Wisconsin. Back to our callers. We've got Mike on the line in Madison now. Mike, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I guess coming from a UW grad that left the state and then eventually made my way back, I think there need to be some incentives for employers to hire Wisconsin citizens and retain them. Maybe the state helps to reduce some of their tax burden over a period of time. And then in addition to that, in concert with that, perhaps a reduced state tax, income tax for the employee, also to try to encourage them to take jobs and opportunities here in the state.
Mike, I want to give Secretary Newsom a chance to talk about that. Do we have anything like that, tax credits for businesses to hire local talent or for the employees?
Well, sure, absolutely. One thing I want to make sure that folks know about, Wisconsin Fast Forward. I encourage you to go to wisconsinfastforward.com. And the governor and the legislature, in an overwhelming bipartisan fashion, passed the Wisconsin Fast Forward legislation back in the spring of 2013. An initial investment of $15 million for employers in the state of Wisconsin to be able to develop customized worker training programs, to be able to hire people and train them based on their specific business needs, as well as to partner up and build what we call bottom-up collaborations where educators and people that work in economic development and employers and K-12 and workforce development people are working together to be able to onboard talent, to train existing workers in the company, but also hire new workers. And this program is one of the kind in the nation that I've seen where it's flexible and nimble. So I encourage employers that are looking to hire and train folks to be able to do that type of thing to go to WisconsinFastForward.com to get more information. And over the last 4 years, the governor and legislature has worked very hard to reduce the overall tax burden to Wisconsinites, whether it's property tax burden, income tax burden, and reduce other regulatory impacts that would disincentivize Wisconsin employers from hiring. And again, that's something that I know the governor is going to continue to focus on going forward.
Secretary Newsom, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Reggie Newsom, Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development. A 107 years ago today, an asteroid exploded in the atmosphere over Siberia in a place called Tunguska, I think I pronounce it right, creating an explosion probably in the range of 10 to 15 megatons. That's the force of a decent-sized atomic bomb. Apparently, no one died because the event was in such a remote area, but it knocked down an estimated 80 million trees in an area over 800 square miles. Fast forward. Today, it's the first ever Asteroid Day, remembering Tunguska and raising the question, what if that happened again but in a populated area? Organizers are calling for an increase in funding for efforts to detect asteroids and redirect them, 100% or 100 times increase over current funding levels. The people behind Asteroid Day include astronomers, astronauts, leading lights of the science world, and one of the lead organizers is Brian May, lead guitarist for the rock group Queen. I should call him Dr. Brian May. I just found out today he has a PhD in astrophysics. We'll share a link to the Asteroid Day website in a little bit on the Central Time Facebook page. You could check it out to see what they're calling for and keep yourself awake at night with the risk of an asteroid event like that. And we're going to go out to the news with the guitar stylings of astrophysicist and lead guitarist Brian May of Queen. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.